This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. One of the very first bills Republicans proposed on the first day of this Congress called for repealing the financial overhaul law that had been passed the year before. But since then, the Republican bill has languished, which does not mean Republicans are giving up. The GOP's latest plan, as NPR's Audie Cornish reports, is what detractors call death by a thousand cuts.
Go to the webpage of the House Financial Services Committee, and what do you find? A Republican video highlighting what's wrong with the Wall Street law. Splashed across the screen are daunting stats, 2,600 new bureaucrats, 300 new regulations. But instead of repeal, the GOP call is for fixing the failed policies of Dodd-Frank. That's Dodd-Frank for the bill's authors, Congressman Barney Frank and former Senator Chris Dodd. Republican Nan Hayworth is a Tea Party-backed freshman from New York. She's had to dial back expectations that the Wall Street law would be taken down in the House the way the new health care law was.
The more we depower and defund Dodd-Frank, the better. But we're doing so in a way that we feel will have the greatest results within the time frame of the 112th Congress.
Instead, Republicans are trying to retool the new law, even the parts of it that haven't hit the books yet, says co-author Barney Frank, the committee's ranking Democrat.
They recognize that the financial reform is more popular. So with health care, they just did a flat-out repeal, and they also offered budget amendments. With the financial reform, they're trying to nibble it to death.
And now is as good a time as any, as many of the law's regulations are still unwritten.
They're able to do what they think. I don't think they'll get away with it. Because attention is focused on the debt and on health care. They're trying to do this beneath the radar screen.
Republicans have been working on four bills aimed at one part of the financial industry law, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which is supposed to oversee financial products from credit cards to home loans. Freshman Republican Sean Duffy of Wisconsin is among those proposing what he calls tweaks to the law. His proposal would make it easier to override rules written by the new Consumer Bureau.
I get concerned when I see regulation after regulation, we just pile it on and we don't have a comprehensive review to see what impact does all of these massive rules have on our banking system.
Of course, Democrats such as Minnesota's Keith Ellison don't see it that way.
If the rules were firmly in place, then we would know whether or not the legislation or the rule needs to be quote-unquote tweaked. We don't know that yet. I mean, because all this stuff is being fashioned now.
There's also a bill that would bar the Consumer Bureau from acting on its full power until a new director is in place. And another would replace the director with a five-member commission. But there's no appetite in the Democrat-led Senate to take them up, according to Senator Mark Warner, a member of the Banking Committee.
I think there are areas in Dodd-Frank that could stand tweakings. But the concern, I think, here on the Senate side is that we don't want to relitigate the whole issue. And if you open up one of these bills, then you don't know what might end up coming back.
But also because there's still a Senate battle looming over who will head the new Consumer Bureau. President Obama appointed Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren to get it up and running with a launch date in July. Whether Warren will be his choice as the first director is one question, and whether Democrats have the votes to confirm her is still another. Senate Republicans have written the president saying they would refuse to confirm any nominee unless there are changes to the law. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capitol.
This is All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Melissa Block. The nation's labor market continues to improve, at least in the private sector. The Labor Department said today that U.S. companies added new jobs to their payrolls in April at a rate not seen in 5 years. But the new numbers also came with a statistical fluke that has economists scratching their heads. Even though employers added nearly 250,000 jobs, the unemployment rate actually went up. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Before the release of today's report, there were signs suggesting the air was going out of the labor market, but the numbers turned out to be better than most people expected. Employers added 244,000 jobs to their payrolls in April, which is above the number needed to keep pace with population growth. And the Labor Department also said job creation was better than first thought in February and March. Austin Goolsbee is chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisers.
The last 3 months, we've added more than 250,000 jobs on average every month. That's very heartening. And the fact that it was really across a whole lot of different industries.
There was growth in practically every sector of the economy, including healthcare, retail, and manufacturing. Professional and business services added 51,000 jobs. The electronics and engineering giant Siemens has seen an increase in orders. Daryl Delaney, president and CEO of Siemens Industry, says the company is actively recruiting employees, especially in skilled fields like engineering.
We have at present over 3,000 job openings. So the growth in the business is really driving the job growth. We have added about 1,000 new job openings in just the last two quarters.
The report sent stock prices soaring, though they later reversed most of their gains. For all of the positive news in the report, it also contained a paradox. Even though the number of payroll jobs increased, the nation's unemployment rate rose from 8.8 to 9%. Most economists consider the payroll number a better indicator of how the labor market is faring. Labor economist Heidi Shierholz of the Economic Policy Institute says there's no clear explanation for why the numbers diverge. But she says no matter what is happening, the job market still has a long way to go to fully recover.
It is still a very inhospitable environment for job seekers right now. We still have over 4 unemployed workers for every job opening.
Today's report came after weeks of disappointing economic news. Just last week, the government said the growth rate slowed sharply during the first 3 months of the year. Meanwhile, the number of people filing unemployment claims has been rising. These reports had suggested that the recovery might not be as strong as expected. The April jobs report has helped ease such fears, but hasn't eliminated them altogether. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. The soaring price of gasoline has been a source of public frustration from coast to coast. According to the American Automobile Association, the national average price for regular gas is now 3 cents shy of $4 a gallon. Coming up, one analyst says the worst is over. But first, oil prices took a steep dive this week, falling more than 10% in just a few days. But that's not reflected at the gas pump yet. Demand is an important element in petroleum prices. NPR's Jeff Brady reports that demand for gasoline in the U.S. peaked several years back, and almost no one in the industry thinks it will reach that level again.
Gasoline demand in the U.S. is on the decline for several reasons. Certainly price has something to do with it. At a national average of nearly $4 a gallon, people are thinking twice about the trips they take, and some are changing their habits. We're on public transportation in downtown Denver. Among the passengers is Sherry Palmer, who started a new job downtown in February.
It's a no-brainer not to take the light rail. It would be crazy coming from Parker not to take it.
Palmer lives about 35 miles away in the suburb of Parker. By leaving her SUV at home, she's saving money every month.
So to figure the numbers, I bet it saves me $200 easily, not counting parking.
And in the process, Palmer is buying about 55 fewer gallons of gasoline a month.
So that's a substantial change by one individual, and that's averaged out with all the people who are making only small changes in their decisions.
Dan Caffeine is an assistant professor at Colorado School of Mines, where he studies how gasoline prices affect consumer behavior. He says individuals respond differently, but overall, economists like him can predict how people will react.
There is a broad literature out there that says in the short run, a 10% increase in price, for example, will lead to roughly a 1% decrease in consumption.
Beyond price increases, a poor economy also affects gasoline consumption. In 2008, as the economy suffered, the volume of gas sold fell by 3%. That's normal in hard times. What's not normal is what's happening now. Even though the economy is improving, demand has not returned to previous levels. That's a big deal because for decades, gasoline consumption in the U.S. followed a steady course upward. This is something big oil companies have known for years. ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson confirmed that something had changed during a 2009 speech in Washington. He laid out the reasons for the decline.
We think going forward that because of the emphasis on energy efficiency, ongoing improvements in vehicle mileage standards, as well as a changing mix over time of hybrid or hybrid-like vehicles, that motor gasoline demand is down. It's headed down. It's going to continue to head down.
Tillerson said another factor is the increasing use of ethanol. There's a federal mandate to include more of it in gasoline. Today it makes up about 10% of the country's fuel supply. There's one more reason demand is likely to decline over the long term. As baby boomers grow older, they're going to drive less.
We believe that gasoline demand in the United States has peaked.
Aaron Brady is with IHS CIRA, an energy consulting firm in Massachusetts. He has an economics background and is a good person to ask this question. If gasoline demand is headed down, then why are prices going up? The key, says Brady, is that we're only talking about demand for gasoline in the U.S.
The Chinas and the Indias of the world are growing very rapidly, and that's tightening the supply-demand balance, and it's causing prices to go up.
Brady says despite what's happening in the U.S., oil consumption worldwide is growing faster than ever. Given that, $4 a gallon gas might seem cheap in a few years. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
And as we just heard, some of the good news from the week is that job creation's been on the rise. NPR's Chris Arnold reports that one particular bright spot for job growth is manufacturing. He's been visiting small manufacturers in New England and has this report.
It's easy to think of U.S. manufacturing as a dying industry, but it's not. The U.S. is one of the top exporters in the world. U.S. manufacturing has been suffering when it comes to jobs. There's been a decline in jobs for decades, and that's because computers and robots do more of the work now. But coming out of this recession, U.S. manufacturers are hiring on more workers again. This latest jobs report showed a gain of 29,000 new manufacturing jobs.
We've hired 9 people since January 1st.
Steve Tomasi is the CEO of Boston Centerless in Woburn, Massachusetts. The company does what's called centerless grinding of metal. Tomasi walks over to one machine that's shaping steel rods that'll go into fuel injectors for cars. The rods, he says, have to be perfectly round down to a tiny margin of error.
Approximately 1/100th of a human hair. That ultimately controls the amount of emissions that go into the air.
A lot of people say that this is the future of American manufacturing, making super precise products with well-trained workers, basically stuff that can't be made as well for less money in places like China. And in fact, companies like this one over the past few years have started selling more products to China and lots of other countries. The weaker U.S. dollar is helping with that.
Once we get in a country, people talk and say, hey, listen, I was able to buy this product at this company in Woburn, Massachusetts, that works fantastic. We sell to companies in Australia, Singapore, Malaysia, China, Israel, Ireland, England.
Another machine here is cranking out steel rods to be used for foot-long surgical drill bits for knee surgery. The medical device market is a big one for U.S. manufacturers. And U.S. companies right now are ramping up production on all kinds of surprising and innovative products.
This is a new design of a bullet that is environmentally friendly. It's a lead-free bullet.
Tomasi walks over to a wooden box that's full of metal bars that'll be made into these new kinds of bullets.
Of the 750 million or so bullets that get produced every year, 2/3 of those bullets are shot on the range, or ranges around the U.S., and they've had issues with those bullets ending up in the fields and contaminating the soil.
Because of the lead, you mean?
Because of the lead that was in the bullet, exactly.
All over the country, there are companies like this, with names that you've never heard of, employing 100 people here, 75 people there, making high-precision manufactured goods. Catherine Shaw is an economics professor at Stanford University.
There's buildings on the highway. They're just sort of blah-looking buildings. You have no idea what's taking place inside them. You know, the name of the company means nothing. There's a lot going on there, and there's a lot of them.
Actually, many companies say that they'd be hiring more people if they could get better educated job applicants, but they complain that most high schools and colleges don't appreciate the opportunities in manufacturing.
People are just underestimating the possibilities.
President Obama spoke to this yesterday after the latest jobs report came out. He visited an auto parts factory in Indiana.
We're going to have a lot of jobs in the service sector because we're a mature economy. But America's economy is always going to rely on outstanding manufacturing, where we make stuff, where we're not just buying stuff overseas, but we're making stuff here and we're selling it to somebody else.
And at least some economists think that we're actually at an inflection point for U.S. manufacturing right now. After decades of job losses at big factories, they say a newer breed of smaller, high-tech manufacturers are well-positioned to sell more products around the world and hire more workers. Chris Arnold, NPR News, Boston.